Abba Mensa to reply.
Well, I'm sorry if I don't look very naive or romantic. I don't even look like a peasant. I forgot to bring me white smock. But I'll do my best. I noticed that a covered dung list started off by attacking the anarchists because there's 57 varieties. There's so many of them, so various, you couldn't tell which the difference. By that, I take it, he meant that when we take socialists, there's only one type of socialist. There's only, wherever you come across the word socialist, there must only be one type. Whether they're carrying out mass murders in Eastern Europe, whether they're extermination camps in Eastern Europe, whether there's reformism in Western Europe, whatever, there's only one socialist, according to him. Because he rejects the fact there could possibly be 57 varieties of socialists. But, of course, we know that all these different, this 5,700 different types of socialists have got one thing in common. They've got a number of things in common, but one thing in common regards anarchism. They always insist on one thing. The anarchist must take responsibility, not only for everybody who calls himself an anarchist, but even for people who don't call themselves anarchists, but are referred to by anarchists by the press or whatever. But they themselves are only prepared to take any responsibility for actually signed up, paid up members of their own particular group. And that goes for the Communist Party, goes for the Trotskyists, for the Maoists, and for the SPGP. And I'm surprised he was a bit audacious in referring to the Butter Mountain, because that's the most significant thing of what he said as regards the SPGP. The original, I don't know if the original idea, but the first apologist for the Butter Mountain came actually from a person whose father was a member of the SPGP, who'd been a member of the SPGP herself, who'd understood everything about the SPGP, had given speeches equally as elegant as his, and had passed over to becoming a Labour minister, Miss Joan Lester. Now, how is it that somebody who obviously knew as much about socialism as it's put as he does, was able to kid herself that bad mountains could solve anything, the Labour Party reformism could solve anything? Doesn't it seem that there's something lacking in the elite itself? That perhaps it might be the case that it isn't the fact that the working class is deluded, but the fact that socialists of every type, whatever they call themselves, always consider themselves cut above the working class. They all think that they can give the working class a leadership, they can tell the working class what to do, and they never have to support the working class. They simply step aside and say, well, you know, all this is quite wrong, we must give you an eloquent speech explaining socialism instead. Now, that to me is not a way to achieve a revolution. And you notice that throughout his speech, really eloquent, he kept saying, we're going to come to the end to how to achieve a revolution. And he kept dodging it. He kept saying, we're coming to this at the end, finish. We're going to tell you how to achieve a revolution. And what wouldn't finish did it come to? A revolution in ideas. Now that's a very nice idea. If we change everybody's opinions first, of course, you don't need any problem. But what happens if the other side wants to shoot them down? He says, oh, you're recruiting people to a bloodbath. Well, okay, so if they're shot down, you say, yeah, they were wrong, they shouldn't have resisted. They should have changed their ideas first. How do they change their ideas? Today, more than ever, and far more than when Marx was alive, the ruling class have far more at their disposal than mere repression. They have to use repression in certain cases. In the Soviet Union, for years, they've had to use it in the name of socialism, but they're gradually turning, you know, they're gradually turning away from mass repression if they don't have to use it. If people are submissive, if people obey, if people do what they're told, obviously they don't need mass repression. It's a logical thing. And people talk about certain races being arrogant. Well, of course, in the case, that's not what creates war. What creates war is that when certain races are submissive, when they take what's told to them. And the majority of Russians have been conditioned by mass repression and by mass propaganda, but particularly by mass propaganda, to not particularly rebelling. And when people rebel, that isn't a revolution. I mean, it's only fools or ideologues who think that, the agitators about pulling people for a mass bloodbath, you know, sort of just come out and shoot a few policemen. But those people don't exist. I mean, that's imagination. You know, there aren't people who are saying, knock policemen tails off and that'll cause a revolution. They're not people who are saying, well, if you shoot enough policemen, no more will come. They're not people who are saying, if we kill enough capitalists, capitalism will go. That doesn't exist. That's what journalists believe, but it's not serious. It doesn't exist. But what does happen, of course, is that you can't bring a revolution about, you can't bring a social revolution about, unless people are prepared to carry it through. Now, how are they going to be prepared to carry it through? Only by being resistant to the evils of capitalism. Now, he pretends he's got a monopoly on resistance to capitalism. Only the Socialist Party of Great Britain believes that the capitalist class is ruling things and the capitalist class has control of the monopoly of production and so on. Well, of course, he knows perfectly well that's not true. But they don't even have, what they don't have is any determination to resist capitalism. When, for instance, Mr. Murdoch really spits in the eye of his workers and they object and they resist, well, of course, that isn't going to overthrow capitalism. You know that. But if they accepted it meekly, that would certainly entrench it very, very strongly. If people are prepared to be independent, they're not going to accept the dictates of capitalism, ultimately. The notion that what they need is a good lecture in economics, and that's all. Well, when they've got that lecture of economics, they'll be superior and they'll be able to go and preach that to other people, is rubbish. I mean, the SPG we know that better than anybody else, because they've been producing generations and generations of people who've had all this indoctrination. And what have they done? They've either, like Mr. Lester, finish up in the government, or they finish up in business, or whatever. They don't achieve anything. They simply go on perpetuating the old myth that they are able to give things to people. They are able to tell them what to do, and the world can be transformed by lectures in economics. Can't they? Only way it can be transformed is by people learning to become independent, learning that by struggling they can resist capitalism, and learning that they can take over the industry themselves. The vast majority of people that Wapping have spoken to, they're not interested in they weren't interested in just the sort of the pyrotechnics of it, you know, sort of the fighting of the policemen and all the rest of it. They were like the miners, but many of them believed previously that the police an independent body which just said to preserve world order. Now they know better. A lot of them believed that the capitalist was giving them work. Now they know better. But even if one supposes that all this was in vain, it wasn't caused by any particular group, any particular people. It was caused by the workers themselves, and it's the workers themselves who have to achieve a revolution, or it won't be achieved. The idea that they're a sort of sociology class that need explanations in order to pass their ultimate examinations is, I'm afraid, a fairy tale. This notion that anarchism comes from a backward peasant, the agrarian economy, well, of course, this again is part of the sort of the common Marxist heritage, which goes throughout the world movements calling themselves Marxists, including all the Stalinists and Trotskyists and so on. They all repeat this story, which all comes, after all, from a period of about 1860 to 1880, when there was a struggle international between Bakunin and Marx, and Bakunin had the support of some of the countries that were more agrarian, and Marx had the support of countries got more industrial proletariat. But when one says the support of countries, I must realise, of course, what does it mean? I mean, about 100 people representing each country, no more. And so this myth, you know, perpetuates itself in Marxism, somewhat like the story of the Good Samaritan, you know, because Jesus mentioned that one Samaritan. All Samaritans have to be good, you see, and this story persists even now. I mean, I'm sure there must have been millions of bad Samaritans over the years, but they're all forgotten, you see. Samaritans are good because they're sort of encapsulated in one parable. Similarly, you see, sort of, even today, when sort of the whole of China is under Marxism and South America is ruled by so-called socialists, still repeat, well, of course, the anarchists are basically a peasant thing and Marxism comes from the industrial proletariat. You see, if one says that the notion of socialism, which he's advocating, is different from the socialism that's been advocated by the dictatorships of the world and by part of the capitalist class, and afterwards part of the university curricula in some capitalist countries, if he says, well, this is different, it's very curious to note how many similarities there are in the theory, although admittedly there are differences in the practice. But then, of course, it's easier for them to be different in practice when they have no chance whatever of practising it, because how are they going to achieve the revolution? They say revolutionary ideas. But, you see, for people to change their views in regard to capitalism means far more than just revising their notions of economics. People have to change their ideas about things like patriarchy. They have to change their views, and people are changing their views about things like patriarchy. People have to change their views about how they're living with other people, whether they regard people as better or worse because they have different nationalities. These are all things that they have to change. These are all things that are part of the struggle. Now, it's no use isolating one thing out of all these things and saying, oh, you see, it's no use saying that you've got to change your views on patriarchy because that's got nothing to do with social revolution. Well, maybe it has and maybe it hasn't. But the point is that people only change their views by practice, by action. And by action, one doesn't necessarily mean violent action, but by action, certainly. When once they change their views, they have different approaches to what they read in the mass media. See this particularly in the miners' strike, don't you? I mean, who are after all more entrenched in the establishment, admittedly the sort of a labour establishment, than the miners? Who more sort of patriarchal than the miners? I mean, it was essentially a patriarchal society. But you saw during the strike how that radically changed, how women became aware of their consciousness, you know, as women. How they entered the strike. They didn't, like in years ago, oppose it. They entered into it. They took over the leadership, practically. All these things happened during the strike. And it didn't happen because they got a lecture saying they should go and do it. They did it out of their experiences, and out of experiences came understanding. And that's why so many of them now think that perhaps the so-called socialists of the day, who said nationalism was a great thing and the Labour Party was the finest achievement of the British working class and flew the flag over the pit heads, they think they were wrong. And this struggle has changed their views. It has not been done solely by written propaganda. It's easy, of course, you know, to go and pick things out and say, you know, take things out of papers and make them sound funny. It's very, very easy. I mean, it's so easy. It's sort of not worth one's while sort of trying to emulate it. But essentially, you see, if you're talking about revolution, social revolution, the change of the whole economic basis of society, you've got to talk about people knowing how to do it, which he says, yes, that can be done by lecturing. But no, it's got to be done by action. That's where we differ. Now, of course, the old bogey about violence, he's not really... nobody ever, or very few people ever believed in violence achieving something in the sense, you know, that it's sort of a positive action. You sort of, let's go and hit somebody over the head with an axe sort of thing. That's a way to get a revolution. A lot of journalists really believe that. But the thing is, what do you do when you're attacked by people who are determined to use violence? What do you do, for instance, if suddenly through the door the National Front burst in and started beating people up? We just stand there and say, well, you know, of course, you don't understand the basis of modern society. You're, in fact, supporting the capitalist class, which is oppressing you. And then you come up with your head streaming with blood. I mean, that's not an intelligent approach. The reason why the anarchists keep getting saddled with these accusations of violence, because it all goes back to the French resistance of the 1880s. During the 1870s, after the suppression of the Paris Commune, the bourgeoisie went round with their police, with their armed guards, killing off one in ten of every worker they saw. If they saw a woman with a box of matches in her handbag, she was shot for being an incendiary. People were shot coming out of work, and this was because the workers of Paris had dared to rise. They were overthrown by the military. And this, incidentally, wasn't advocated by the anarchists alone. The Marxist Karl Marx as well claimed to support it, but apparently that was okay in 1870 and wrong in 1936. But after this happened, after this repression happened, they were in a state of apathy and lethargy. The workers were in a state of apathy and lethargy. They felt it was impossible to fight back. That's when the anarchists started the individual resistance, when they started shooting off members of the bourgeoisie, throwing bombs in cafes and all that. And you see, the journalist or the politician will take this thing out of context and say, the anarchist Emile Henry threw a bomb in a Paris cafe. You see, a crowded cafe. See, of course, it sounds horrible, doesn't it? But one thinks that this was full of bourgeoisie, and the bourgeoisie had just taken part in these massacres, and this was a way of hitting back. It gets a sudden difference. Now, actually, I work as a printer, actually, on a particularly right-wing newspaper, Daily Telegraph. I saw a copy they wrote. I saw it going through, as it were, which said it was about anarchists in Carrara who wanted to raise a statue to Bresci, who shot King Umberto after he had ordered the killing of 20 textile workers. Now, when that actually finally appeared in the press, they missed out the article in 20 textile workers, and I'm sure that's been collected in bits of notes that Comrade Donnelly has. You see, how terrible, how absurd. Just killing the king for no reason. Probably thought you were going to get a revolution as well. They probably thought that would overthrow the country. But of course, you see, it's a vastly different kettle of fish when you look at the things objectively. And the point is, anarchism says that yes, there is a problem in overthrowing capitalism, but that's what one should turn one's attention to. But in order to get the majority of people to do it, one's got to support them in every struggle they have against authority. Otherwise, they won't want to do it. Because nowadays, the mass media have got such a hold on people's lives that it's impossible to answer, that public opinion is mass-produced. I mean, the question of hanging or flogging or anything is a mass-produced thing. You can get the answers. You can get answers of sort of 70% people for hanging or for flogging, only by means of conservative propaganda in the press. All the propaganda in the press is devoted to it. So it's not only the state one has to, only the capitalists one has to fight, it's also the state, and it's also, of course, the media which is used for the state. And of course, the police Of course, they're recruited from the working class. At any rate, they used to be. I mean, nowadays they tend to come from slightly higher strata. But they're used quite positively by the state in order to enforce the legislation that it makes. Without them, Parliament just becomes a debating chamber. But without them, the people could simply walk in if they disliked a factory owner, printer like Mr. Murdoch. All they have to do is walk in and take his presses. But they're conditioned to say that, well, this is impossible. The police are there to make sure it's impossible. But that's why. So you've got to think in terms of not just overthrowing capitalism, not just overthrowing the state, and not just abolishing the means of repression, including the media, as it exists. But you also have to think in terms of supporting every struggle that goes on, providing it's moving towards that society. Otherwise, you're just talking sort of airy-fairy nonsense, and we'll be carrying on forever.